the expression from the music inspired me so much to take risks, and it inspired damn near the whole rap game.
Hello again, I'm Adam Ons. You may know me as the host of The Opus, and now I'm bringing my own show, The Spark Parade, to the Consequence Podcast Network. I speak with artists and creatives about the cultural artifacts that spark their personal interest and creativity, whether it's music, books, movies, video games, or any other kind of art.
I've never spoke about it in this amount of detail. I'm suddenly going, oh my God, I'm blowing my own mind here, Christ. It's actually a giant part of my life.
By talking about the things we love, we share and discover insights into our personality and the things that drive us.
It's just magic, really. I mean, frustrating. And it makes some people angry, but I don't think anyone's ever done anything like it.
I speak with people like Connor Roberts, Phoenix's Thomas Mars, Chris Gethard, Helen Hong, Adrian Young, and more, so their sparks of inspiration can start a fire in you.
I'm grateful for those who continue to put our history and who we are as a people in the forefront and make you see it.
Find the Spark Parade wherever you get your podcasts.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Story Behind the Song, the Consequence Podcast Network series where I interview the iconic artists behind the most iconic songs of the past few decades. I'm your host, Peter Chadi, and each month I dive deep into conversations with your favorite musicians of all time to get insights into the creative journeys behind their most popular and lasting songs. I also ask each artist about one of their personal favorite deep cuts from their own catalog, and in the process, these living legends reveal frequently surprising, never-before-discussed details about these songs and their creative journeys, as well as candid reflections about their personal triumphs and challenges. In this episode, I speak with John Linnell, one half of the multi-Grammy-winning group They Might Be Giants, whose quirky song Birdhouse in Your Soul unexpectedly broke out to rule the indie charts in 1990 and continues to be an eclectic music connoisseur's favorite more than 30 years later. The band is like no other, with their signature frequently surreal melodies played with unconventional instruments and featuring enigmatic, frequently silly lyrics laced with non sequiturs, and Birdhouse in Your Soul is certainly no exception. After all, it's not every day I interview an artist about a song sung from the perspective of a nightlight. It's no wonder then that John and his fellow giant John Flansburgh also wrote Tony Award-nominated songs for the SpongeBob musical on Broadway and for classic films like Coraline. We also discuss John's pick, one of the band's most recent songs, a far more sobering one called If Day for Winnipeg, from their latest album Book, released last year. John and John will undoubtedly feature that one as well when they hit the road for their 40th anniversary tour in early June. So take a listen as we dive deep into the story behind the song with John Linnell of They Might Be Giants. So John, where are you today?
I'm in Brooklyn. I'm actually in my studio in my basement here, although I've actually completely started taking everything apart. I don't know how well you can see, but I'm tearing it all apart so that a builder can come in and build an apartment out of this. We've got a really complicated plan here, which is I'm moving my studio and we're going to turn this into a sort of bachelor pad for my son.
Ah, interesting.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
So do you use it right now for some of the recording?
Well, I can't anymore because I've torn everything apart. But
right.
But yeah, I was up until yesterday. I was this is where I've been doing home recording. And a lot of vocals that wind up on They Might Be Giants tracks do sometimes get recorded in here. If the take is good enough.
Yeah.
You know, I'll use the demo vocal. And a lot of other stuff gets performed down here.
Excellent. So listen, as we were saying a little bit beforehand, As always on The Story Behind the Song, we go deep into two different songs. The first one being one of your most iconic songs, and you have several that are iconic, but I chose one. Mm-hmm. And so that will be the Birdhouse in Your Soul, of course, which is a classic. And then I asked the artist to choose one of their favorite songs. It could be any song. And you chose If Day for Winnipeg from your last album, your 23rd album that was released last year.
Yes.
So we'll get into that. But before, I have to lay out a few accolades for the band.
Okay.
Okay, so multi-Grammy winning, obviously with a string of hits. You've released 23 albums, as I mentioned, your last one last year. Known for your kind of funny, non-sequitur, a little bit quirky, but very individualistic songs. And also nominated, I didn't know this, for a Tony Award for Best Original Score for the SpongeBob SquarePants Broadway musical.
Yes, correct. Yes.
And what's interesting about that is my last guest was Alex Ebert from Edward Sharpe and Magnetic Zeros, and he too wrote a song for that same musical.
Yes. Well, we ran into a lot of other artists that we knew at the Tony ceremony, and it would have been weird had our category won because there was like, you know, 50 people up for the same. In other words, the number of artists who were just in the SpongeBob team was like massive. That's probably why we didn't win. It was just too many people.
Well, look, you've obviously your music's been involved in a lot of soundtracks. And one other one that was of particular note to me, because it's very personal to our family, is Coraline. My mm-hmm. daughter, who's studied music, and I always kind of managed to work her into these episodes, but she's a huge Coraline fan. And so our father's song was a song that you had written, or the band had also, I think you sang it yourself.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. I was the singing voice of the character that John Hodgman had voiced.
Yeah.
So I felt sort of a weird kinship with Hodgman there, where I was trying to represent him as a singer.
It's such a classic movie. It's a great movie. So first, before we dig into the first song, Birdhouse in Your Soul, from your 1989 major label debut, Flood, John, take me through a guided tour of just some of the highlights of how you, as a young lad, how music first attracted you, how you first got into that, and then where you met your partner in They Might Be Giants.
Let's see. John and I met in high school. Well, actually, we met a little before high school, but we became friends in high school. We were sort of kindred spirits. We worked on the high school newspaper together, but we also hung out and did other creative projects together. And I guess we both gradually drifted into doing music. John was very interested in recording. He had a lot of recording gear early on. So he started with a I guess it was like a Tascam reel-to-reel machine, and he'd figured out how to bounce tracks back and forth between the two sides so that you could overdub a whole composition using just the two-track machine. And then I was just sort of like goofing around on the piano and other instruments, and I joined my high school concert band on bass clarinet. So we were both kind of, in a way, exploring and mostly self-taught in music and in recording. And it took several years to get to this project, but we both wound up in New York together. I guess it was 1981. And we moved into the building that our friends were already occupying. It was like a very inexpensive tenement building in Brooklyn that a bunch of people were all kind of piling into because everybody knew everybody else from our hometown.
Did you and John plan on moving in together? Is that how
well,
it happened?
Well, we know, but we did move together. I was living in Rhode Island, and he came down from Boston and picked me up in Providence, and then we drove the rest of the way together to Brooklyn, and we took two different apartments in this building. We had different roommates, but we, you know, it was just a gang of people from our high school, who were all living in this building. Yeah. So it wasn't a coincidence. We did move down together, but we both had, for different reasons, we both wound up coming to New York at the same time.
Gotcha. Okay. And so when you moved in,
yes.
How did it come to be that you two decided to actually start making this a project? And did it just, you tell me.
Well, it did begin sort of organically. I was playing in a professional working new wave band that was out of Providence, Rhode Island. And the band had decided to move to New York and try and, you know, make our headquarters in New York. And meanwhile, John and I continued doing some of the creative work that we'd been doing together, and just goofing around, we didn't have much of a plan. But eventually we decided that what we were going to do was record one of those plastic flexible discs that you used to find in magazines. I don't know if you're probably old enough to remember. They were really inexpensive.
Thanks for reminding me, by the way. But oh, yes, you know, I am old enough. I am old enough to remember.
Yeah, they were usually advertisements for, you know, recordings. But it was like a plastic, very very flexible, usually printed on black plastic disc that you could play on your record player, but you had to weigh it down because it was so flimsy. And we found out that you could, I think it was an Evatone sound sheet company or something like that down in Florida. And you could press up 1,000 of these. That was the minimum number that you could make. And it cost, I don't know, maybe it was $1,000. Did they cost $1 each? I that seems expensive now. Maybe it was less than that. I can't remember. But anyway, this was our idea. It was like, we're going to make one of these and just give them away, you know, and that'll be our project. And so that was kind of the first thing that John and I put together that was like to send out into the world.
And did so from the beginning, did the quirky nature, I guess. I don't know how better to put it. It's that your idiosyncratic nature of your music.
Sure,
did you two share that from the very beginning? So I think
I would say we had a shared sensibility, and we probably shared it with other people that we grew up with as well. I think we just wanted to do something interesting, and that was what came out. You know, it was we liked pop music. You know, we love the Beatles and a lot of the pop bands that were coming out at that time. But we also liked stuff that was more oddball and artsy. And I think we just wanted to do something. We had both done other bands that were probably more intended to be appealing to other people. And we wanted to try something that was just something we liked, you know. So that was the idea, was we'll just do a project that is what we would like rather than something we think would be actually successful. And that's what right. turned into They Might Be Giants.
Okay, so tell me about that. You started doing this project together and doing it your way and trying something different.
Yeah.
So what was the first big break of that?
Well, I mean, it was all very gradual, but we had a couple of really oddball lucky things happen. One was that we made a cassette following the you know, Evatone thingy, that the little disc that we made. We made a cassette of sort of our first set of things, and it got reviewed in People magazine, which was really odd. You know, somebody just heard it and decided, I'm gonna add this to the music reviews and the regular music reviews in People. And that was a year before we got a record deal or anything. So that was a kind of just a weird UFO for us, that we'd felt like we were suddenly, you know, I don't think 1 million people became aware of who we were as a result. It was just like, it was this thing we could point to, you know.
Well, People magazine back in the day was a very, very big magazine. And so you make a cassette and something like that doesn't naturally find itself into somebody from People magazine. So you must have been distributing it in some kind of way.
Oh, we were. We were advertising it. We were giving them, I can't remember how we, Flansburgh is actually, would have a probably better memory of how we were actually getting these cassettes out. But I think we were, part of it was we were in New York and we had lots of friends who were sort of in the, you know, arts. And so these cassettes were circulating at that point, and it somehow it got into the hands of somebody who thought it would be cool to review this completely obscure indie cassette in People magazine. And we started performing in public at that time too. So we were coming up with different ways of advertising. And then the next big thing, well, this was before the People magazine review, was we came up with this idea called Dial-A-Song. And
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. So that was probably only about a year into doing this. We got an answering machine, which in those days used to be a big mechanical box that played, this particular one played audio cassettes, and it had an outgoing cassette and an incoming cassette. So you could, it was ideal for us because you could take different songs and put them on different cassettes and then swap them in and out. So we'd have different songs, try and put on a different song every day was the idea. And obviously the audio quality was very, very low. But that was okay. It was people listening to music over the phone, which nowadays is a normal thing to do. But back then, it was like a very humble idea to produce our songs so that they'd be listened to on the telephone. And we advertised on the back page of the Village Voice. It's a single line advertisement that just said, "They might be giants, Dial-A-Song." And if you could figure out what that meant, and there was a phone number, a lot of people just called it because they were wondering what the hell it was.
It's great marketing. That's really brilliant, actually. And I was going to ask you, and I want to save some time to the end to start getting into the fact that you're ahead of your time when it came to doing innovative ways of distribution, including online and the internet and all that good stuff. And so I want to make sure I get into that a little bit because the tech forwardness of what you do. And I'd like to ask you about some of the Web3 stuff, NFTs, because that seems like a natural perhaps for what you all are all about.
I think we look for something that suits our project. I think we're very ecumenical about how we distribute and send out our stuff. But I think that the stuff that comes off as like pure sort of commercial exploitation is something we're very, very turned off by. So I would say that in general, we're just looking for more ways to do our regular kind of creative work. And, we've tried out a lot of things, but we're generally not on the cutting edge. We're not the first people to do most of these things. We just are very open-minded about what we do, I would say. And I think that in the spirit of, the great thing about Dial-A-Song, for example, was it was the price of a regular phone call. And of course, none of the money went to us. It was all going to the phone company, You might say there's nothing particularly noble about that, but it was, I think we were trying to, telegraph this idea that we were something that you could discover on your own, and that it wasn't, we weren't trying to get you to join our cult, and we weren't trying to rope you in. If people were interested, if people felt like they personally responded to it, then they were welcome. But basically it was open to anybody, and it wasn't an expensive proposition,
Totally get it. And before we take our first break, I do want to get into the name of the band. And you've covered They Might Be Giants quite a bit. But is it true that you first called yourselves El Grupo de Rock and Roll?
It's actually partly true. We were not even the ones who referred to ourselves that way. We were playing at a Sandinista rally in Central Park. This was the first time John and I had stood up in public and performed. And we had a friend who said, oh, I know where, I've got a gig you guys can play at. And it was the anniversary of the Sandinista party, the Nicaraguan, political party. And they just wanted someone to come and play music. So we were like, great, we'll do it. And I don't know whether we were in any way appropriate, but we got up on stage and this guy introduced us in Spanish. He said, please welcome El Grupo de Rock and Roll. That was it. It wasn't something we had planned. It was just how we were referred to. And we hadn't come up with a name at that point. So we had to think of something. And I guess the thing with the name is that, you know, it's sort of like one of the earliest decisions that you make. And a lot of bands have trouble defending whatever it was they were thinking. There are lots of band names that I love, but they usually don't correspond to the band name, the actual bands that I love, if you get what I'm saying. In other words, there's bands that I'm not wild about that have really good names. And then there's some of my favorite bands have terrible names.
I gotta ask you some examples of both.
Okay, well, I respect the Grateful Dead, but I'm not really a fan of theirs. But I think their name is one of the best band names that there is.
Yeah.
And I think the Beatles is one of the stupidest band names in existence, but they are probably my all-time favorite band. So, you know, that's just how it pans out. I don't know what the name They Might Be Giants means anymore. I don't know what it signifies to anyone else. At the time, it stood out because there were a lot of bands that were using kind of formulaic band names. The names they came up with were supposed to let you know what kind of band it was. You see what I mean? So there was new wave bands often would take a noun and repeat it, you know, be like, you know, pencil or something would be the, that at that time, this was, you know, 1981. And then there were, you know, so you sort of get an idea of what the band's about based on the name. That was really probably the main idea. And so They Might Be Giants, I think we were sort of thinking it would throw people off because it wasn't at all clear what the name meant. It was just, a sort of mysterious idea for a band name at that time.
And how do you feel about it today?
It's sort of the way you feel about your, when you look in the mirror, you know, it's hard to even really make sense out of, you're so accustomed to yourself that you don't even know what you're seeing anymore. And I kind of feel that way about the name They Might Be Giants. I don't know what it means. I suppose it could have been worse.
Well, for those few out there, well, maybe there are many who don't know where that name came from or how it came to be. Tell us that.
It was a movie that was being broadcast on TV while John and I were having the conversation about what should we call our band. There's a movie with George C. Scott and Joanne Woodward, and it's just another one of these elliptical, like, you know, that's an unusual name for a movie, kind of thing, you know. That was one on the list that we had made.
What was number two?
Well, I remember at one point we were thinking of Dump Truck, and there was another band at some point around that time that called themselves Dump Truck. So luckily we dodged that legal bullet.
Right. Well, very good. Listen, it's good to have that little tour. And then we're going to get into the first song, okay, Birdhouse in Your Soul. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with John Linnell of They Might Be Giants. So, John, let's get into Birdhouse in Your Soul.
Sure.
Which is the first single from your major label debut, which was 1989's Flood.
Yes.
And first, before I ask you about the song, was it an unusual transition from being on the indie label to a major label? What was that experience like?
Yeah, well, it was, luckily for us, it wasn't too wrenching because we'd had sort of a very rapid but steady increase in our audience on the first two albums that we'd made, the two indie albums that we made. So by the time we were on Elektra, it was like we were already sort of on the ramp going out, you know, launching. We had a kind of a pretty good idea of what we were wanting to do at that point. So I'd say it was not uncomfortable. It was still pretty exciting and surprising how well the third album did. That was you know, we didn't know what to expect. We had nothing to compare it to. But it was fun and crazy that year. Actually, I should tell you that Flood came out in 1990. We spent the summer of 1989 recording it, and the fall, I guess. And then it came out in January of 1990. So it was kind of like the next decade had begun, and we were on this whole new trajectory. And we had a company that had a big international presence, you know, so that made a huge difference. We were able to really get promoted in all these faraway markets, and we'd show up in countries that we'd never been to, and we'd already be established. We're just doing a much bigger touring, had a much bigger touring operation. But we were still us, you know. I think that the nice thing about Flood is it felt like we hadn't really changed what we were doing. We were just getting better at it and getting more famous at doing it. So, you know, it was good. It felt good, actually.
Ah, that's great. And okay, so let's dig into the song a little bit. Do you remember, do you recall how it even first came to be?
Well, of course, as you said, we've talked about this song a lot in the past. So I've had to go back and try and kind of reconstruct some of this. I thought of a couple of new things to say about Birdhouse for your benefit. One of them was I was thinking about the lyrics, which are, you know, I do not remember where they came from. They were kind of lyrics that you'd make up to a melody that's already been written. That's the way I'd often work. That's the way I still often work. But I do remember I was, I think, probably partly influenced by this Charles Mingus composition called Better Get It in Your Soul, which is from Mingus Ah-Um, that album. And it's I don't know what, again, like, I don't know what Better Get It in Your Soul or Better Get Hit in Your Soul is somehow is how it's written. I don't know exactly what that means, but it just felt like a good collection of words. So I just took it in a slightly weirder direction with Birdhouse in Your Soul.
Well, it's the first interview I've had where a song comes from the point of view of a
nightlight. Yeah.
Right?
It's a night
of a nightlight. And even though after all these years, because I was living in Los Angeles, this song was everywhere. The album was everywhere in 1990, K-Rock, like ubiquitous, right? And so I know the lyrics to the song.
Right.
But I never thought about it until researching this a little bit, that it was actually the point of view from a nightlight.
Well, it's, you know, it's one of those things where you, in my case, I guess, I gradually come up with these lyrics and then I, after the fact, figure out how to make sense out of them. So there wasn't initially this plan to write a song that's sung by the nightlight, but it was sort of like, well, that's a topic that hasn't already been, you know, nobody else has written this, so that's a good place to start.
So let's do it.
Yeah, exactly. Aside from that, I would say like a lot of ideas come from the sounds of the syllables of the words, you know. And I'm not the only person who writes songs like that. That you have a melody. Usually, you start with a melody, and then the melody suggests a kind of set of syllables that work with those particular notes, right? And then often you kind of let the song write itself in that way. You know, I've written plenty of songs where there's a much more obvious narrative. So there's more than one way to do it, obviously. And it's funny that Birdhouse was as successful as it was, because it's one of the most oddball of all the lyrics of the singles that we've put out.
Was it an obvious first single for you?
I think we knew it was going to be the single. By the time we'd gotten to recording it, we had demoed it. And, you know, the thing with Birdhouse was it actually was a very gradual process writing that one. A lot of songs, John and I write songs very quickly sometimes, and those are often the best songs, where you have the whole idea at once and it comes together and you know exactly what you're doing. You know, it's really obvious when you're writing the song where it's supposed to go. And this was not really the case with Birdhouse. It was more like, here's a melody. What do we do? Like put these pieces together. And some of the sections were written long after the song had been started. And in fact, some of the sections came up in the recording studio when we were working with Langer and Winstanley, the producers, that they would say, for example, and this was not just Birdhouse, but some of the other songs, that it's the song is good, but it's not long enough. You know, they'd say, like, we have to get past the 3-minute mark. So we need some kind of an instrumental break, right? That would be a typical way to do it. And then so we'd go, all right, okay, let's do that. Let's cook it up. And we, in the case of Birdhouse, we made up this kind of, it has nothing to do with the rest of the song, but it's this, it's sort of an homage to the instrumental break in the Love and Spoonful song, Summer in the City, which has, you know, that has honking horns and it's got this guitar run and stuff. And it's a really beautiful part of that song that just, it evokes something that's kind of, you can't say it in words, but it just gives you a feeling, right? So that's what we were shooting for.
The song Hot Town, Summer in the City. That song.
So we basically stole the chords from that instrumental break. It's the same chord progression, except it modulates around a little bit. And then we added these trumpet stabs that were actually sampled from the trumpet playing of a friend of ours, Frank London, who's we worked with a lot. And if I'm remembering correctly, he had been sampled without his permission. So we then sampled those trumpet hits off the record and used them on our record with his permission. So we were basically stealing them back. So that's what that instrumental break is all about. But it was put in there at Clive Langer's request. He wanted to make the song a little longer.
How about that? So, okay, because the lyrics aren't obvious and your methods are not obvious and they're a little bit, like I said, idiosyncratic. And there are two of you. And so how do you both share similar sensibilities?
Well, part of the process for John and I is that we are conscious of the other person looking over our shoulder. So when either of us is writing, we're thinking, oh, well, what's John going to think? And more to the point, what would like grab him? You know what I mean? Like, I kind of know what I'm doing and I know what I would like, but what could I do to blow the other guy's mind? You know? So that's a big part of our writing process, is that we have each other as kind of editors and, you know, people to try and impress, you know? And that's been a really good thing for both of us. I think we both feel like it helps. It really helps with the whole process to have someone else to bounce everything off of. We do a lot of collaboration as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you were saying that there's not really one process, that sometimes it's different for different songs.
It's different for different songs. And when we talk about If Day, I'll get into that, because that was a real collaboration.
Yeah,
but John Flansburgh essentially wrote the song, so we'll talk about that next.
There's one line in here that just cracks me up, and the filibuster vigilantly, like, you know, how you come up with that. And I guess the way you best describe it is that it's wordplay.
It's what words get fit in with the melody that's already been written, you know.
Right.
And often I get very uptight about making the rhythms consistent. Ralph Waldo Emerson said something about consistency is the hobgoblin of the small-minded or something like that. And yeah, and I kind of feel like I do get sort of hung up on trying to make everything follow this strict rhythm. And that often makes the words, it forces the words to be more convoluted because I'm sort of obsessed with trying to iron everything out. And then, you know, often, I mean, I have to sort of give up and relax a little bit because there just are no words that work perfectly with a given melody. So you have to be willing to be flexible and change the melody a little bit. But I'm always resisting that. And that's part of the tension, I think, for me of writing lyrics.
And how do you feel about the song today?
Well, it's a fait accompli. You know, it's just it's just the thing we do now. It's like breathing.
It just is.
You know, we haven't had to think about what it means or anything forever, because a lot of people in the back, you know, the back of the room are just coming to the show to hear the songs they already know. And usually one of those is Birdhouse. So we're duty bound to play Birdhouse, you know, or something as popular as that.
Gotcha. Okay. So we're going to take another quick break. Okay. And then we will be back to talk about one of the less familiar songs, because it's a new song. And the new song, well, from last year's album, your latest album, is called If Day for Winnipeg. And I learned a lot researching that song, too. So we'll get into that after a quick break. And we are back. We are back with John Linnell. We're going to be talking about If Day for Winnipeg, which is a song that you chose. Because, again, story behind the song, we discussed two songs.
Yes.
And that was your pick. So tell me why that song, you selected that particular song of all your many songs.
So I wanted to pick something from the most recent release. And that is, I mean, technically it is a John Flansburgh song. He wrote it and he sings it. But it was an example of the way that he and I collaborate very often. And in fact, there's a million different ways that we collaborate. So this is just one example of how it could happen. But in the case of If Day, I sent John a lot of audio materials, and one of them was just this, I don't know if I can describe it very well, but it was a bunch of drums that had been put through a process called ring modulation, which does a really crazy thing to any percussion instrument. And then it has this funny rhythm where there's sort of it's kind of like a 3-against-4 rhythm if you're technical in the rhythmic arts. Anyway, so there's that, and there's a bunch of odd sounds. And John, you know, I've done this plenty of times in the past, given him materials. He's given me materials, and then we just use that as the kind of the base, the mother sauce. I don't know.
The bouillabaisse.
The bouillabaisse of the song. And so John took that and sang over it. And he was interested in this topic, this particular topic that he wanted to write about, which is the traditional ritual in Winnipeg, in Canada, where they enact a kind of what-if scenario, where they imagine, what if the Nazis had won World War II? I hope I'm getting this right. And that's why it's called If Day. They imagine what if the Nazis had won, and then they kind of have a day of performative activities involving that as a way, I suppose, as a way of being grateful that the Nazis didn't win the war.
So they so this is something they still do.
Well, I don't know, actually. I know that it has been a thing. And it had a long tradition, and I don't know whether it's still going on.
So when I heard that you wanted to discuss If Day for Winnipeg, the title itself sounded unusual to me, but it didn't surprise me because you're idiosyncratic, and so some of your titles are a little bit, you know, a little bit different, which makes them fun and playful. So If Day for Winnipeg that's what I understood about it too. But now let me ask you a couple of questions about that, because you said that John wanted to do a song about that. So do you know why that was in his mind?
Yes, I do. I think he felt like, as I do, that we are entering a climate now, a political climate now, where a lot of the norms that we that we as old men are so accustomed to are being challenged. And one of them is democracy itself. We feel like we're in a dangerous time where democracy is no longer necessarily accepted as a basis for our society. So I think that's really where he was at. The lyric in the song is, if day is for everyone, yeah, meaning, obviously, we're all having to imagine losing those freedoms and the notion of democracy because it seems like all the cards are suddenly up in the air. I don't want to put too many words in John's mouth because I think he could articulate this better, but that's the basic idea.
Yeah, and it is, unlike Birdhouse, there's so much dissonance to the sound itself. And you were talking about you put the percussion or the drums through a ring modulator, so you have this ominous sounding something.
Yeah. Well, I didn't have any specific thought about what the sounds meant, but I think John just listened to it and kind of came up with the lyrics based partly on the feeling of that, I guess. And he added some cool stuff himself. The super scary low brass sound, he made that, and I still don't know how he made that sound, but I that's my favorite thing in the whole song, is that crazy sounds like a tuba, yeah. But it's like a tuba from hell kind of thing.
It's ominous.
Yeah.
It's definitely ominous. But it makes sense from based on what you described, what the song is about.
Again, you know, we often do songs where we're not that worried about the music and the lyrics being perfectly in sync. And sometimes there's a certain pleasure in them having there being some cognitive dissonance going on, like some disagreement between the vibe of the music and the what the lyrics are saying, you know. And I think one of the nice things is you can often write a song where you get everybody to sort of hum along with the melody, and then they realize the words are something completely in contrast to the feeling of the music. And that's, I still really get a kick out of that kind of thing.
So let me ask you about that, though. When you were talking about John shared this with you, first of all, he lives in a different city, I guess.
Well, he has his studio in upstate New York. Okay. So he does most of his work up there. He has an apartment here, but he can't really make noise in his apartment. So he's got a really nice production studio in this, off in the woods up in upstate New York. And then I mostly work right here in Brooklyn, in the basement here. So we do a lot of sharing of materials over the internet. That's just a very normal way for us to collaborate.
And that's been the way
it has been. Okay.
It has been for a long time.
For a long time. Yeah. Yeah. There was a time back in the day, I think probably back in the 80s, where one of us would walk to the other person's house with a floppy disk, you know, so that was the highest bandwidth you could achieve was just the walk down the street with the flop, with the 1.4 megabyte floppy disk, and you know, here's the samples and here's the sequence, go crazy, you know.
Yeah, I remember those
days
now well
it's,
too.
Luckily,
so when he shares, you said you look over each other's shoulders a little bit, obviously, metaphorically in these cases, since you're separate from each other. But so when he shared that. In this particular example, If Day for Winnipeg, and do you question it? Do you just accept it? The lyrics for that? How does that work?
I sometimes don't know what he's talking about, but my sense is that it might not really help to try and pin him down, you know. So we don't interrogate each other too much about stuff unless there's something. I think if there's something that bothers one of or the other of us, we might say, not so much what are you talking about, but maybe this is coming off not the way you intended, or you know, I mean, occasionally there's things like that.
Yeah.
Where you're like, I don't know if this will mean the same thing to the world that you want it to mean, and maybe there's a way to make it clearer, or you know what I mean? But that's unusual. I would say most of the time John and I are like, you know, have at it. It sounds great. Do your thing.
Okay. So your tour kicks off June 8th of in New York City, and it's going to be going for many, many dates into 2023, and you're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the band, and you will be, at least on some of the shows, doing Flood, your 1990 album, in its entirety during the tour.
That's correct, yes. You know, obviously the big concern for this tour and the reason we've had to postpone it is because of the safety of the audience members and the concern about the band getting sick from this pandemic. And you know, I mean, obviously the stakes are kind of high. If a member of the band gets sick, that pretty much knocks the whole thing on its head. So it's a very dicey situation, obviously, for anybody touring right now. You know, we've been trying to figure out how to do this. The month of June is going to be an extremely low-key beginning, where we're doing repeated shows in particular cities. So we'll have three shows in DC, and then a couple shows up the East Coast, and then three shows in New York City, and that'll take us through June, actually. We're starting off very low key, in other words, and then assuming that everybody's confident and the thing is working out, we're going to be doing a more typical, traditional tour of the United States in the fall.
And before we end things, as I had previewed before, I want to get into a lightning round where it's going to be just a couple quick hits and your visceral reactions to it. So your favorite artistic / career moment, you know, something that stood out to you.
I don't have a favorite, but there are just occasions when we've been going along a sort of trajectory of, you know, record an album, do a tour, you know, go home, write more songs. There's a kind of a cycle thing that's been going on for the whole history of the band. And then occasionally we just depart from that in some odd way. And one of the ones that comes to mind is we started writing songs for each of the venues that we performed in. And this was many years ago. But we would come up with a very quick song at soundcheck, you know, the day of the show, and then record it at soundcheck, and then perform it that night at the show. And the song would generally take the subject of either the city we're playing in or the gig we're playing in. And then we put that out as an album. And that was called Venue Songs. And so there are things like that that just, I think that we keep ourselves entertained often by coming up with ideas like that that are just completely off the regular track of putting out the collection of most recent collection of songs that we've written and then doing a tour to support that, which is fine. I mean, I love doing that as well.
Okay. So, this is gonna be another difficult one probably, but what are you proudest of in your body of work?
Well, all the songs complement one another. I think, I don't think there's a particular one that like I would want to strip out and have it stand alone. I think I like the fact that we have done such a diverse, you know, eclectic collection of songs and recordings, and that's, I think I'm proud of the whole thing as a kind of a, you know, I like all the obscure ones. All the deep catalog. Maybe that's what I'm proudest of, is that we have a deep catalog.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And if you didn't become an artist, musician, what would you have done, do you think?
Well, I was really good at this job that I had in the 80s, where I worked in something called a stat room, which I'm pretty sure there's nothing like that in existence anymore. But I had this enormous camera that pointed down, and I would photograph art and transparencies and things underneath, and then the negatives that were produced on the top were then given off to the art department. They would do whatever they were doing, and this was all part of the process of doing analog multimedia back in the 1980s and probably for a lot of the 20th century before that. But all of it, of course, was made obsolete by computers. So I can't do that anymore, because that job doesn't exist. But that was the gig. That was my job at one time. I was also a bike messenger before that. So I could go back to doing that, I suppose. There's probably still bike messengers in New York.
Oh, bike messengers have made a huge comeback. Electric bikes, though. And then finally, who are some artists that you really admire? And not as much icons. You had mentioned the Beatles as an example, but are there any particular emerging artists or artists that maybe aren't particularly mainstream, but you find them to be really, that they speak to you?
Sure, yeah. Well, there's loads. And I could talk about the ones that we were excited about when we first started. You know, John and I were really into The Residents, for example. That was a band who just completely broke every norm and came up with an entirely original way of working, and we were very much into everything they were doing as musical artists. I don't know. It's actually in a way it's almost hard to single out somebody because they're so unique and original that they are not examples of the way anybody else should work. You know, the great thing about a lot of original artists is that there's no point in trying to copy them. You know, they were doing something deeply personal, and presumably they still are. I'm not very on top of like who's who nowadays. But I always appreciate when somebody appears to be completely making it up from scratch. That's really incredibly appealing thing.
Well, that's a great way to end this, because there's no question that you all are a band that is one of a kind.
Whoever cared about topical things, but now that this day has arrived.
That was John Linnell, one half of the quirky, idiosyncratic band They Might Be Giants, sharing his in-depth story behind their classic, playful indie hit, Birdhouse in Your Soul, and their very different and more somber and haunting new song, If Day for Winnipeg. I'm your host, Peter Chotti. You can follow me on Twitter, at PChotti, that's PCSATHY, and at deepcutsmedia.com. For more of the story behind the song, make sure you like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And tune in on the third Monday of every month for new episodes. Also, make sure you're following the Consequence Podcast Network to keep up to date with all our series at consequence.net/consequence-podcast-network. And as always, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song.
Hey there, it's Kyle Meredith from Kyle Meredith With. After you check out the latest episode of my show, be sure to check out some of our other great programs on the Consequence Podcast Network, including Standing BTS, a bi-weekly podcast covering all things BTS and ARMY, and The Opus, Consequence's original documentary podcast exploring legendary albums and their lasting legacies. So head to consequence.net to listen to these podcasts and many great others.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.